and I had to start again with just my children and my wife. I thank my lucky stars to be living here today, but the flag still stands for freedom, and they can't take that.
Action Line, and we are on again tonight with a show that we think you'll enjoy. My name is Maurice, but you can call me Mo, as you know, and of course our co-host is Eliza Jane. We always like to welcome Eliza Jane in and get a good word from her. Good evening, Eliza Jane.
Hey, Mo, how are you doing tonight? I got to tell you, you know, that song just makes me want to stand up and put my hand over my heart and face the flag. And as much as it said, God bless the USA, I think we can say God bless the USA and Canada.
Good, very good comment. Yes, I was thinking about it the same thing. We have been interacting with our Canadian friends. We realize they have a lot at stake this year with their election in 2019. And we're fortunate to have had guests before. Tonight, we have a connection with Canada as well. We have Christine Douglas-Williams joining us tonight. And we're going to get to know her and where she does her work, which is Jihad Watch. And so we're going to welcome in Christine as well. Good evening, Christine.
Good evening. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you for joining us. We want people to get to know the work that you do at Jihad Watch. Before that, we'd like for them to get to know you a little bit better. Why don't you give us a little bit of background and take as much time as you'd like. It sounds to me like you've had an interesting last few years in your work.
Well, once upon a time, a few years ago, that ended in 2013, I was a daily talk show host, Open Line, in Canada, and was recipient of 9 international awards that came from the United States, actually. I also wrote a book called The Challenge of Modernizing Islam that was commissioned by Daniel Pipes in the Middle East Forum. It was an institutional bestseller. And I authored a book published by the Center for Security Policy that's called Fired by the Government of Canada for Criticizing Islam, Multicultural Canada, a Weak Link in the Battle Against Islamization. And that ended up being a bestseller with the center. And I'm a regular daily writer for Jihad Watch, and I'm also an associate editor for Front Page Magazine. I'm also public affairs and media consultant for the International Christian Embassy in Jerusalem, Canada. I've been writing for several years, and I was with the I still write there from time to time, the Gatestone International Policy Council, where I was once on their board of governors, and external advisor to the Office of Religious Freedom here in Canada, and I was also a former conservative-appointed director to the Canadian Race Relations Foundation, and that's where I ended up getting fired once the Trudeau government came into power.
Well, that's a wonderful set of accomplishments for a very young person. I'm just thinking ahead of all the things that you will be accomplishing going forward. I think most of our listeners
not so young,
like,
but I'll take the compliment.
Well, let's just say you've accomplished a lot, and given the rate, the prolific writing that you do, I'm sure others will follow. Let's dive into your experience with Justin Trudeau's Canada and what the difference was when he was elected, and maybe even a little bit about the campaign and how he was elected. I think most Americans are not particularly familiar about any connection there may have been between the Obama administration rooting and cheering for Justin Trudeau to become the number one guy in Canada. Could you give us a little bit more background about Trudeau and your own experience at
That's a very interesting question that you ask, how he managed to come in. First of all, one needs to remember, and Canadians know this very well, they watched Justin Trudeau grow up from a child in front of the cameras because his father, Pierre Elliott Trudeau, was a brilliant statesman. Yes, he was a liberal, associated with the communists, but he was a very popular, charismatic statesman. So the cameras followed him, not just his politics, but also his family. And Justin Trudeau got a lot of advertising while he was growing up from a child. So already that endeared him in the hearts of Canadians overall. Now, when he decided to run for power, Canada was in a very interesting position because Canada was facing a lot of debate as to where we go from here when it comes to the Constitution, when it comes to free speech, when it comes to, frankly, issues regarding Islam, specifically because the burqa ended up being a big issue when it came to a public debate, and it was at the point where, in 2015, where people started to wake up and realize what was going on in Europe. So that debate was alive and well in Canada, and Quebec was actually, parts of Quebec were actually, was actually opposing the burqa and other practices such as honor killings and so on that could be and was entering the borders. Now, the Conservatives ended up bringing in a bill called the Zero Tolerance Against Barbaric Cultural Practices. Now, that is where the Liberal government started to play the political correctness card, saying that that bill was an insult to different cultures. It was racist. It was Islamophobic. The usual posturing that we see going on, still going on in society. So at the same time, there was a scenario where a child, a little Syrian child, apparently washed up on the shores, and I'm trying to remember exactly where in Canada, because I'm trying to take this back to when Trudeau was first elected and why. But this child made front pages, and it was the Conservative government that was deemed to be anti-immigrant, cold-hearted, against refugees that want to come to the country, and this is what ended up sinking the Conservatives in the elections. It was presented as though Muslims were being witch-hunted, ethnics, visible minorities, immigrants, that the party was anti-immigrant. So here comes Justin Trudeau, who was winning the hearts of the people based on his history. And not only that, but he did a brilliant campaign. He was actually setting up polls and setting up promotions campaigns in colleges, where a lot of kids today don't even care about politics and don't care to vote. I remember when, take for example, on YouTube, which is a very popular medium today, Trudeau actually threw himself down a flight of stairs And he has this way of winning the public heart, public's heart. This is what I can do. I can throw myself down a flight of stairs. Well, that won a lot of viewership. And people say, well, what does that have to do with politics? Exactly. But he won the hearts of the people. So the conservatives were set up as these far right, outdated folk that is racist, and Trudeau was set up as this newcomer that is young, he's attractive, he comes from this family, and Canadians fell for it, they voted him in, but that romance with Canada didn't take long before it started to end. Trudeau went to India, and that was the ultimate embarrassment, because the leader of India, Modi, didn't even come out to see him for days, and Canadians were asking the question, why is he even in India for that long, for 7 days? Who's paying for this? And then he ended up being in breach of ethics because he went to the Aga Khan Island on Canadian dollars and racked up quite the bill. So there were issues facing Trudeau. When he was questioned in the public square, he started to fade. For example, and I'm fast-forwarding this here to recent times now, the issue of ISIL fighters has been a major issue in the public square. People have looked at Europe. They've seen the chaos that has happened in Europe. It doesn't take two brain cells to realize that open-door immigration is simply a means for these Islamic State fighters to come through that stream. In fact, the Islamic State fighters said long ago, we will infiltrate your streams with the refugees, and they did. There's plenty of documentation that they did. Even in Canada, our central intelligence, CSIS, has come right out and said, look, we've got ISIS fighters among us. We can prosecute them. It's difficult because they've committed crimes overseas. How do we begin to do this? What would the cost be? How do we even track down what they've done overseas? So therefore, they're being allowed to roam free. Again, Trudeau gets questioned in Parliament. What is his answer? Welcome to everybody, including ISIL fighters, because they can possibly be a powerful voice for de-radicalization in Canada. People started to wake up, and when the latest scandal happened with a company called SNC-Lavalin, a big cover-up scandal, he started to fall more and more. And right now, according to polls, he's pretty much neck and neck with the Conservative Party, if not even lower. So that is it in a nutshell. I mean, there's plenty more to say about anti-Islamophobia motion M103 that passed in Parliament, what that means and so forth, but I'm just giving you a little briefing as to what we're facing here in Canada. And the border, of course, that we share with the United States that is deeply threatened given his policies when it comes to immigration and his laxness when it comes to terrorism, jihad terrorism particularly.
Wow, Christine. So with all of that that's going on and all of and him going down in the polls, what's your interpretation? Do you think he has a chance of winning?
I wouldn't go so far as to say he does not have a chance of winning. I'll put it that way. I would say he definitely has a chance of winning. And Canada also has another issue because we also have Maxime Bernier that's running as a conservative. Not as a conservative as in Conservative Party, but he's running his own party because he's a breakaway from the conservatives and started up his own party. And many Canadians were concerned, what is that cause? It's a break, it's a split in the vote. Now, fast forward this, and this is my own analysis. I know that there are people that are diehard supporters of Maxime Bernier. He has come out with some really brilliant ideas when it comes to fighting jihad terror and so on, but there is a concern about the split in vote. But according to polls, it looks like the Conservatives could be headed on a win. That's what it looks like now, but we all also know that polls aren't necessarily right. So our fingers are crossed that the Conservatives, at least I'm saying the Conservatives, but again, there's Maxime Bernier, but the hope is on our side, and when I say our side, people who oppose mass immigration, people who are standing up for the truth, standing up for Judeo-Christian democracy, the hope is that the Liberal Party of Canada will not win, because it is a tragedy if they won again when you look at the trends in Canada, and particularly the rise in power of the Muslim Brotherhood interests fueled by the Trudeau government.
Well, Christine, are the Conservatives as engaged in Canada as it seems they are here in the United States?
You're talking the people or you're talking the Conservative Party?
Well, actually both. The people in terms of being aware of what's going on and actually going to the polls and voting.
through word of mouth, I would say, and through organizations such as the Rebel Media and Sun Media, it looks like people are starting to wake up. I would say that Canadians in some way are sort of a cross between Americans and Europeans. When one looks at the trends that are going on in Europe, Canadians are paying attention like the rest of the world is. And we've seen the rise in the populist movement for a good reason, because of what we've seen on the other side that has caused chaos in Europe. One sees that living in Canada and notes what is happening here. And given that Trudeau has fallen in terms of the public opinion of him, I would say that, yes, Canadians are waking up. Canadians are, the conservatives are starting to spread. We have had a relatively small, but I would say significant, yellow vest movement going on in Canada. And while the yellow vests originally were about economics in France, it has evolved to include issues of immigration and national security as well. And in Canada, it more has to do with immigration. So I think given the coverage that we see in Rebel Media and in Sun, and a little bit, I would say, in the mainstream media, people are getting some trickle as to what's going on. And of course, even the liberal media has been mocking Trudeau like crazy because of the nonsense he's been saying, particularly when it comes also to ISIL fighters, because people in Canada are very concerned about national security based on what he has said there.
It's our understanding that the response has been that, and I'll just repeat what I think you said, is that these people can be either rehabilitated, they can be given grant money, they can be brought into the society, and somehow they can be a force to de-radicalize or prohibit radicalization. That's a real stretch. I'm just curious if there's a backlash against Trudeau for saying things that sound really ridiculous if you're concerned about your family and your safety. Is that part of the pushback that he's soft-pedaling?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Because even Global News... Yes, even Global News, that is a national mainstream media, Global News, had publicized a humiliating report about what Trudeau said when it came to ISIL fighters, that they can be a powerful voice for Canada, welcome to Canada. In fact, after Donald Trump announced, and that was quite a while ago, about his temporary ban on Muslim immigration, that is when Trudeau stood up and said, welcome to Canada, anybody is welcome, we're an open country, diversity is our strength. This is what he went out there and said in response to Trump's ban, that, by the way, most people, I think, know by now, those countries were actually chosen by the Obama administration, but the actual coming out with this, the ban, the actual putting it forth, was with Donald Trump, but it came from originally Obama. So when he came out with that, that was Canada's response, and it did draw a lot of criticism. And I have to congratulate the opposition leader, Andrew Scheer, who took him to task in the House of Commons. And he was not easy on him, and that got a lot of traction in the media as well as on YouTube. So all of that, it has Canadians concerned. What are we doing now? In fact, if you look at the UN Migration Pact, it was Canada that came out and said the Liberal government was leading the charge in the UN Migration Pact. Canadians are concerned. And I think when one looks at the reaction from people because of that UN Migration Pact, it has led to a lot of surprise. The far left brought and globalists brought this thing out expecting that the average person, they were so egotistical, it didn't occur to them that citizens might be a little bit concerned about their safety. But country after country have come on board and said, look, we've had enough. We're not signing on to this plan. And Justin Trudeau has gotten some serious concerns when it comes to his openness about open-door immigration and when it comes to what he's allowing into the country, and he doesn't even seem to bat an eyelash as to what this is going to do to Canadians. For CSIS, the central agency, to come out and say, look, jihadists are among us. We're not doing anything about it. That was a huge, huge warning here in Canada. So I believe Canadians are waking up, and we have that hope in the next elections, and it's looking good for the Conservatives, but one does not have a crystal ball, so we really don't know what's going to happen in the next few months.
Well, this is really important to all of us, Canada, for Canada to be a sanctuary country to our north, if that's what happens, if Trudeau wins, would be continue to be a real problem for America. I'm just curious how powerful the Muslim Brotherhood is. We would have to say, and we do pay attention, as I know you do, at Jihad Watch. The Muslim Brotherhood is very powerful in the United States and is probably winning the battle right now just because of the apathy of a lot of Americans and the infiltration that they've had in the Obama and still have in the D.C. government. So in Canada, it's just curious. One of the articles that you did publish was about an Al-Qaeda-linked charity in Canada helping a Toronto Islamic center raise funds to turn a church into a mosque. And we've seen that happen here. This whole notion of the Muslim Brotherhood positioning, being able to convert a church, but it demonstrates a weakness. There are empty Christian churches in America, North America, and there are people that are anti-Christian. Trudeau actually said the following, according to that article, which I believe was under your name. Prime Minister Trudeau said that evangelical Christians are the worst part of Canadian society.
Yes. That's right.
Oh, my God.
That's right. He was actually quoted as saying that to a pastor out west, Pastor Long out west, a Baptist minister. Now, to your question about how powerful the Muslim Brotherhood is in Canada, it is very powerful in Canada. In fact, the group, the Muslim Association of Canada, which has chapters in basically in every province, they have right up on their website that they are Muslim Brotherhood, that they originate with Al-Banna. They come right out and say it. So this is huge. We've got groups like IRFAN, like the Islamic Relief. We have the NCCM, the National Council of Canadian Muslims, that is formerly CareCan. And when they first changed their name as a rebranding, the leaders came right out and said their mandate hasn't changed. Their origins have not changed. We've only changed our name, and that was part of a rebranding. But to show you how popular they are, when I got fired by the government of Canada, it came out in the Toronto Star story that the NCCM had been advising the Canadian government that I should be fired for Islamophobia because how horrible it is that I could exist on a Canadian Race Relations Foundation and be so Islamophobic is appalling. That was appalling. But when one looks at the power of the NCCM in Canada, they have gotten into the school system in terms of the curriculum. They have defined Islamophobia as including hatred toward Islam or Islamic politics. Now, that drew shock from B'nai B'rith and from many others, but B'nai B'rith took them to task. And it came out in the National Post what that definition was during Islamic Awareness Month, and the district school board, the Toronto District School Board, had taken that definition from the National Council of Canadian Muslims and had to retract it and change it a bit. But the fact is, this is what they came out with, that definition of Islamophobia. In addition to that, six Canadian major cities have adopted Islamophobia as part of a kind of a charter and recognized it. This is spreading like wildfire. When anti-Islamophobia motion M103 came out and was adopted in Parliament, the media came out and said, oh, this is not legal. This is not a problem. This is just simply a motion. And all these right-wing, far-right nuts are just making a story out of nothing, just pointing to boogeymen that don't exist. But nobody was really, at that point, on the left or in the mainstream media, paying attention to what Islamophobia really is and watching what was going on according to the various definitions. They didn't see it coming. They said it was a harmless motion, but motions that are presented in Parliament are actually, the purpose of them, they actually lay the groundwork for future legislation. So it is a groundwork building in Canada. Another thing very important happened as a result of M103. There were a lot of consultations with many Muslim groups and others in society into the anti-racism business and so on. And what came about was a $23 million plan to battle discrimination in Canada, which includes Islamophobia. When going through that document, it is scary. It talks about monitoring citizens for compliance when it comes to Islamophobia, training different sectors when it comes to offense, when it comes to Islamophobia, a $23 million document. And the document actually vows to employ certain individuals that will work with the government to help deal with issues of discrimination and Islamophobia. Now, the Muslim member of parliament, Iqra Khalid, who was the one that tabled the motion, happened to slip during an interview, and she came right out and stated that IRFAN and the National Council of Canadian Muslims were going to be two groups that will be part of that plan. So Canadian tax dollars are going into these groups that are connected to the Muslim Brotherhood, and Canadians have absolutely no say about it. But I believe, based on feedback, that people are starting to wake up and say, what is this Islamophobia anyway? At the most primitive level, it is being discussed that there is nothing phobic about it. There's reason to fear because it's legitimate fear. We're seeing the crimes committed across Europe, the sex attacks, the jihad attacks, the calls for more attacks. We're seeing it happening. We're seeing the persecution against Christians. We're seeing the objective to obliterate the Jewish state of Israel. The writing is on the wall. And every time something bad happens, like what we saw in New Zealand, which was atrocious, 45 Muslims killed. That is put forth as a tragedy, which it is. It was murder. But at the same time, people are ignoring the hundreds of thousands of Christians and minority groups that are being killed each year since 1948. Imagine that. Up to 12 million, between 10 and 12 million Muslims have been killed by fellow Muslims. And this is something that is being ignored. Add that the Yazidis, add the Christians, add the other minority groups, the Hindus, everybody else. Why are these kinds of deaths and assaults and the treatment of women being ignored across the board? So Canadians are asking questions and wondering, what's this Islamophobia really about? Thank goodness the internet provides a space and a site like Jihad Watch to educate people on where Islamophobia really came from in the first place. And it's being pushed heavily by the Organization of Islamic Cooperation that has defined it in two stages. One being anti-Muslim bigotry, which should be the word used when it comes to bigotry against anybody, but the other is criticism of Islam, which hurts the feelings of Muslims. The word Islamophobia, there's no phobia about Islam, needs to be done away with once and for all. It should not be accepted in any Western country because it is the first stage of Sharia law because it aims to shut down free speech, and it's being rather successful, and people, I think, are starting to wake up in Canada and across the board, hence the popularity of the populist movements that continue to be demonized fiercely by globalists.
Christine, if you get a new prime minister, do you have such a thing as the executive orders like we do here in the States that the president can actually undo some of that kind of thing? Would the new prime minister coming in possibly undo the M103?
Yes, there are powers like that, and they're not quite called the same, but there are powers when a new government comes into power. I have to say happily that the Conservative government of Canada has talked about its platform, and free speech is actually one of their top priorities. So as the governing powers of Canada, if they happen to come in, I have no doubt that we will see a lot reversed. I have no doubt. And
excellent.
I hope, and I would tend to think, that this M103 will be thrown out. I certainly hope so, because they will be certainly pressurized to do it. And based on their mandate for free speech, this should be in the making. It should be expected. One positive thing that we've seen recently, after the massacre that we saw in New Zealand, which was atrocious, the opposition leader, Andrew Scheer, came out and expressed his condolences, but he did not use the word Muslim. And I don't think it was deliberate. We don't know what the man's intent was, but he did not use it. And Muslim groups went crazy saying he did not use it. And they were pushing him into apologizing and using the word Muslim. He stood up and he did not bend one bit. He is sorry for what took place, and he knows it's Muslims that were killed. Whether he intentionally left that word out, nobody knows, but he refused to bow to the pressures, the enormous pressures of the Muslim Brotherhood groups. And that was something that that was a real plus for Andrew Scheer, because there was concern for a long time that he was weak when it came to dealing with Muslim Brotherhood interests.
But we do see care in the Muslim Brotherhood. Go ahead, Mary.
No, sorry. No, I was just thinking this M103, and I saw an article on your Jihad Watch that I think was from Pamela Geller, talking about how Canada moves to ban Christians from demonstrating in public under that new anti-hate, and I'm assuming that's M103. Basically, she's stating that she thinks the Muslims are now a protected class that prevents any kind of discussion on Islamists.
Now, there was a problem with the article's title, and I don't think that was an intent, but this is what happened.
Okay.
Canada did not come out. If you go back and read it, you'll have to go to LifeSite News that had the original information about this. This has nothing to do with the Canadian government. It has nothing to do with Trudeau. This was
okay.
a private member's bill that came from an MPP, a member of provincial parliament in Ontario only. And it's not expected to survive scrutiny because it's against the Constitution. So it does not look like it will pass, and it was not a Canadian at all, did not come from the federal government. It did not come from Trudeau. It was merely a small private members bill that was not targeting Christians, but it was suggesting that there are groups that are going out there in demonstrations and they're being offensive to certain members of the public. In fact, not offensive, but maybe bringing hate against certain people. And what was strange about this, if you would like to look at it a little closer, is that why, at first when I heard about it from LifeSite News, I thought, who is this MPP that would bring up a private members bill? Surely it had to come from the New Democratic Party or the Liberals. And when I saw that it came from a Conservative MPP, I wondered, why would this come from a Conservative MPP? So some of the thinking behind this, or some of the analysis is, this was not intended against Christians or Jews or other faiths at all. It could have very well been against these Islamic supremacists, because we have groups like Al-Quds and Al-Quds Day that come out there, and actually they don't just protest. They are calling for destruction of Israel, the killing of Jews, and the killing of Zionists. So that could have been the purpose behind this Ontario private members bill. But once again, it is a private members bill that came from Ontario. People need to go back and read that. That did not come from the federal government.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification. It just seemed to fall into line with M103. And
yeah,
I wasn't sure if it fell across. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Good
nothing
for the clarification. Thank you.
So we were talking about the Muslim Brotherhood and CARE and the impact they have. One of the articles that caught my idea from Jihad Watch within the last week was the one that where CARE was condemning Law and Order, the perhaps most popular television program of all time. One episode of Law and Order got CARE upset for Islamophobic episode, and they demanded a meeting with the production leaders. I know you covered that.
Yes.
We have some good news. I'm encouraged by what you said so far about Canada. The one problem with the Muslim Brotherhood is that they are incredibly capable. They never stop. They work 24/7, and so you keep seeing them in all kind of cultural events like TV Jihad. That was an important article that you covered to let people know that even the TV shows that we watch are being impacted by CARE and the sensitivity to Islam.
They certainly are, and we have to say that we need to applaud Law and Order for being brave enough. I will not applaud somebody for insulting anybody's deity. That is not the issue I want. That is not the impression I want to leave here. But I do applaud them for being brave enough to tackle this. And the reason why I say so is because Hollywood producers and other producers and anybody, in fact, many people, in fact, in the arts have insulted Christianity, have insulted Judaism. They make fun of Hindus, fun of Christians, fun of everybody. That's Western culture. Nothing is so-called untouchable when it comes to free speech, when it's done in jest. These things are done in humor. Lighten up, will you? And that is really what happened on that program. It made a bit of a mockery. Apparently, that's what they're suggesting. That's what CARE's suggesting of Ilhan Omar. And they just scream bloody murder. But you see, here is the big problem we have here. Why is it that CARE and groups like them feel that they can come out more than anybody, above anybody, and proclaim you as a nation, as a people, have no right to insult Islam, to offend Islam. There is no legislation when it comes to people's feelings. Yes, Canada is different than America when it comes to the First Amendment. We do have hate laws here, but they were intended for a reason. When we look, for example, at what goes on Al-Quds Day, the call to murder giant Zionists, to murder Jews, to demonize people, this is the kind of reason that hate laws were put there in the first place. When the Human Rights Commission first came out in Canada, it was because blacks were having trouble even finding places to live because of the racism that took place. That was horrible. So laws came into place to protect the genuinely victimized. When one looks at how the Uyghurs, for example, are being treated in China, we had our own situation of the Japanese redress. And in fact, that is how the Canadian Race Relations Foundation was born, as a result of the Japanese redress. A wonderful fellow by the name of Art Mickey, that was the founder of the Canadian Race Relations Foundation, he signed an agreement with Brian Mulroney. And this was called the Canadian Race Relations Foundation Act that compensated members of the Japanese community. And it was also a declaration in the formation of the Canadian Race Relations Foundation Act to make sure that such violations of human rights will never happen, such overt racism, attacking people because of their faith or because of their race in that kind of context. It was never intended that, a race, because Islam, first of all, is not a race, but even if it's a race or a creed, that you can't say anything because it's offensive. It has nothing to do with the reason why hate laws were erected in Canada. These were erected to protect the most vulnerable against the kinds of abuses that we see going on rampant, ironically, in Islamic states. That's why those laws came into being, because if one wants to look at hate, it is exhibited in volumes according to normative Islam. And this is something that is not being addressed by these so-called anti-hate people that are constantly parading themselves and pretending to care about human rights. So that is why the hate laws came into Canada. So I'm just giving you a little background there in the context of what we're speaking of here. So going back to law and order, to make a joke out of a religion, what have we come to as a society, even in America, that they're brazen enough to go out there and say, oh, we're offended, so therefore we demand that you get basically re-educated. We want to meet with your producers, to meet Muslim groups, that's what Kerr said, so that they could understand better about Islam, so therefore they will learn not to make fun, which was such nonsense, because it was merely a show. If jokes went out, for goodness sakes, that is the nature of Western society when it comes to free expression and free speech.
But if that had been a joke on Christianity or on Hinduism or on Judaism, there would not have been a sound.
Nobody bothers. The Christians don't bother. The Hindus don't bother. And that's another thing that offends me, because I'm considered a visible minority. And I have noticed that visible minorities are left out of the equation. We spent some time recently, the family, in Florida, where we are friends to a group of Hispanics. They are diehard supporters of Donald J. Trump. And they see what is happening. You would not find harder working people, and they're disgusted watching others come into the country and say, oh, racism, racism, because we're not getting our expectations. So we have seen here that there are those that are of the visible minority groups that are huge supporters of border control because they want safe countries. And you also have Muslims that are saying, we don't want this place to become like what we've left back behind. This is not what we want. But these are the voices that are being left out of the mainstream media because the presentation by globalists and by the mainstream media is white against everybody else, the us versus them. In fact, there's a bigotry of low expectations that I find very offensive because it does not deal with the abuses going on in Islamic states. It does not deal with black-on-black violence, and it does not deal with the fact that long after whites have evolved, colonialism no longer exists, apologies have gone out endlessly, and America saw a black president. We're seeing slaves in Mauritania, black slaves by the Arabs. We're seeing it in Algeria and in Sudan. This is acceptable among Arabs. And we're also seeing how the Afghans get treated in Iran. They sit at the back of the bus, but nobody seems to make an issue of these human rights abuses that are ongoing and constant. It is an us versus them mentality to use white guilt and to basically usher in an agenda that will break down Judeo-Christian democracy. Now, David Horowitz captured it very well in his latest book when he talks about the attack on Christianity and the roots of Judeo-Christian democracy that built our fine system where everybody, including Muslims, could live in peace if we hold to our own constitutions.
Well, this feeds into the whole international back and forth related to what you were just talking about. For example, one of the articles this week is about Merkel, Angela Merkel calling out populists as the enemies of Europe, destroying globalist values. So this whole notion of globalist values, citizens of the world, being critical and associating nationalists, people who want rule of law, with white supremacists. I think in Europe, the whole notion of far right and Nazis and racism and, you know, that has a reality to it. But I think they've tried to use that to attack what we might call right-wing politics, not far right-wing politics, not racist politics, bigoted politics in America. Well, my curiosity is, when you look at Angela Merkel and the article that was in there, curious, some of her own remarks criticizing European to allowing populists or nationalists. She says they're the enemies of Europe and they destroy global values. Does that rhetoric play in Canada? I mean, it certainly does play in the United States. The globalists in America, Democratic Party, and many Chamber of Commerce Republicans are in fact globalists and will look the other way and allow anybody to come into the country as long as they bring cheap labor with them. How does somebody like Angela Merkel or the leader of France, do people associate that with Trudeau? I mean, Trudeau's comment, I know he said this, is that Canada is a post-national country, which I think means it's just part of the world and people can come and go as they want. When Trudeau says a post-national country, what do Canadians think?
That is a very important question that you brought up there, this whole concept of globalism, post-nationalism, and pointing out the populace as being the enemy. It is exactly the same with Trudeau here in Canada. He is pretty much the Emmanuel Macron of Canada. They're all of the same kind of a mentality. Now, what I find rather interesting is how they confuse the discourse and people are buying into it. They start off at a point where they've established, and people, I think, are waking up, an us versus them. White people have committed too many sins. We have been so nasty to those brown people, but they don't look at what's going on in these other states. But they look at it entirely from a white versus visible minority point of view. And I find that so offensive and, in fact, racist against whites, because what it implies is that white people could never escape the past, never. And it also implies that visible minorities can't escape the past. And in addition to that, because of that kind of rhetoric going out, it blurs the vision as to what's going on today in the world and what the enemies really are, and to call them out. The argument of globalists goes like this when it comes to nationalism. First of all, they have everybody believing that Nazism is far right. It's actually not. When one looks at history and one looks at Hitler and who his close friend was and who he learned from, Stalin, that was far left. They abhorred capitalism and, in fact, everything that so-called right-wingers stand for. So they were actually far left. Through the process of the enemy, which was the Bolsheviks, what happened there, and that's going to have to take some digging because people have to do some research here themselves as well. The Bolsheviks were deemed to be on one end of the spectrum. So therefore, because they were the enemies of the Nazis. Therefore, the Nazis must have been far right because the Bolsheviks were considered far left. But the fact is, they were all fighting among themselves. But the Nazis and the Stalinists, they were all socialist thinkers together, and they were all far left. But they have people thinking today that it's that Nazism is actually far right. So they have really confused the discourse over the years. So they've established that. And because Nazism was deemed to be a nationalist movement, they have simplified it so that anyone who uses the word nationalism, no matter how that person might mean it, it forms a picture in the mind of Hitler. They're very good at simple language, pictures, and branding, which the right is not as good at doing. So they use the word Nazism, and it conjures up a vision in one's head. It doesn't occur to people that nationalism simply means allegiance to one's nation. If one's nation happens to be a model of human rights, where people could live in peace, then those living under that honorable banner should be very proud nationalists in that context. The Western civilization has come a long way. It has grown to be bastions of human rights. And as a result, the nations need to be, such nations need to be protected. Judeo-Christian democracies as nations need to be protected. So so-called populists that are being deemed nationalists are really individuals that are trying to protect the common sense approach, free speech, that people need, because free speech is a protector against fascism. There is no fascist government that honors free speech. It is absent. Free speech is absent in Islamic states. Communist countries, it's absent. So why on earth would people not see that challenging free speech is a major problem? Populists, are so-called populists, are trying to maintain the values of the nations that espouse Judeo-Christian democracy under human rights and freedoms. But the globalists, who are threatened by that, and they have their own utopian vision of socialism and Marxism, which has always been a vision, by the way, and it's always been a utopian vision, and it's never worked. One sees the extent of murders that have taken place under these types of regimes. But this is the kind of lesson that has not been learned even through the course of history. So when we see people like Angela Merkel, who is a globalist, and Emmanuel Macron spewing off about how the populists are the enemies and they're the nationalists and they're trying to destroy Europe, they have it all backwards, because they are fighting for a Marxist model for Europe, and they want that under an EU umbrella. They were the ones that came forth with the UN Migration Pact. They were pushing it through. In fact, they tried to bully the Visegrad group, particularly Poland, and try to drag Poland to court, and even Hungary, actually, over their resistance to migrant quotas. And that was a while ago. It seems like a long time ago, although it was just maybe a year or two ago. And it was Viktor Orban that stood up and said, no, he is going to resist these globalists. He is not going to open his border. And he has been branded every name in the book, just like Donald J. Trump. And most people, because the media will not air this, do not realize that the government of Viktor Orban has been paying millions of dollars into third world countries where Christians are suffering persecution and minority groups. He has been helping out with these different groups that support these persecuted groups in these countries, but they're busy calling him a racist and an Islamophobe because he wants to protect his borders from Islamization. So they are the ones that have confused the discourse with this utopia that they have, that Marxists have always carried. We could be one big happy world under Marxism, while the past has proven that very wrong, and we see it happening today. So everything tends to be a bit backwards. What is really the enemy of freedom and human rights is being dubbed, unfortunately, the friend of everybody, which it is not. The populists are the ones that are trying to say, look, we're trying to preserve our borders for everybody to live in peace. No matter what their creed is, we want them to live in peace. You look at Canada, it's a multicultural nation, as in every culture. You look at the States, it is, and I call it multicultural with a small m, because it is not sanctioned in the government legislation. But it is a country of many cultures, but these this information gets left out of the discourse. So why is it that all of a sudden there is upheaval when it comes to people coming in from Islamic states? Why is it that Hindus were here all along, blacks were here, the Chinese were here, every group was here, and there were no problems? But as soon as Islamization began across Europe and the problem started with these Muslim Brotherhood groups who have infiltrated the West, and people say, oh, it's and this is something that Frank Gaffney has put out, and he speaks of quite regularly in the Center for Security Policy, the Muslim Brotherhood plan for North America. Every citizen should have read that document before they even open their mouths and start to speak and even enter the debate, because it's like trying to argue with numbers. And when you don't even know 1+1 is. The Muslim Brotherhood plan for North America is not invented. It is documented fact that was entered into a case, the Holy Land Foundation trial. And it is a frightening document that lists exactly how the Muslim Brotherhood intends and it did infiltrate North America. There was also another document called The Project that was discovered in the Al-Qaeda Maghreb, and that is frightening because it looks almost exactly like the document, the Muslim Brotherhood document. The only difference is it is intended for the Islamic Maghreb, and it is clear the way the document discusses that it is important to discover the society that you're living in every way. Learn about the society, learn about the culture, learn about the people, and basically become a chameleon in order to infiltrate as a fifth column. This is what is happening, and the Muslim Brotherhood has taken over because it knows that the worst thing you can call the white race are racists, Islamophobes. This is something that is terrified the UK so badly that we saw God knows how many girls assaulted, raped, so-called groomed, and they called them Asian men. They were discovered to be Pakistani men, Muslim men, that did it because it is sanctioned in Islamic law that they can take infidel women at will. This is what we saw happening, that even the system violated the law. Police were involved. The social workers were involved in this cover-up. When they were supposed to be protecting innocents, they sold them down the river. And MP Naz Shah, and she's still an MP, came out and retweeted that those girls, those victims of the Muslim rape gangs, need to shut up for the good of diversity. This is what we have going on, and this is what the Muslim Brotherhood has pushed. And the entire system that we see happening here, the entire erosion by Islamic supremacists, is coming right from the Organization of Islamic Cooperation right down to ISIS. There is a huge relationship there. I know the Muslim Brotherhood likes to say that there is no relationship between violence, between ISIS and the Muslim Brotherhood and other so-called peaceful groups, but there is. It's the same end, and they're fooling people.
Well, I think we have an opportunity by looking at the European countries that you mentioned to understand how those countries have been transformed, how some of them are pushing back. Let's go back to the UK. You've actually introduced a really important set of topics. So over a period of 15 years or more, there's been very, very aggressive immigration from Pakistan and other parts of the British Empire, bringing in large numbers of people who are Sharia compliant. There are Sharia courts in England. And now we have, of course, the mayor of London, and we have increased crime. But wait a minute now, there's an organization about Britain First, and we just have had major back and forth in England with Brexit, and we just had a resignation today or yesterday where Theresa May is resigning over the Brexit failure, and you covered that in your article today. Maybe you could touch about that as well as a really important statement from a good friend who's been following that, Robert Spencer.
Yes. Now, we know that Robert Spencer was banned along with many others, Pamela Gallery. There are many people that were banned from Britain, even Franklin Graham, because of the, I call her Appeaser Theresa, because that is what she has done. She has appeased the Islamic supremacist group in Britain. She has actually talked about the value of Sharia law, and you mentioned about the Sharia courts, there are 85 of them. Now, everything has blown up in her face, and she's decided to quit. That's basically in a nutshell. Now, because of the experience of what Appeaser Theresa has been doing in the past. In fact, she went so far at one point where she even, in a meeting, she equated Robert Spencer with terrorists. This is what she did. So Robert Spencer right now is on a needed hiatus, and a lot of prayer has gone in, but we're hoping that he can be back soon. But this really this really got a rise out of him, and he texted something to me. In fact, he was quite amazed by the fact that she would ups and quit. And I said, well, would you like to maybe text me, since you're texting, if you would like a statement, and I could maybe include it in my article. And he did. And this is what Robert Spencer issued, and I published it on Jihad Watch today. Theresa May was an absolute disgrace, the worst prime minister of Great Britain in decades and possibly centuries. It is she who confirmed the mass immigration policies that have so seriously undermined British society, and who cracked down hard against all who protested, seriously eroding Britain's centuries-long traditions of free discourse and free inquiry. Even if Britain survives as a free nation, future generations of free Britons will loathe her name, unquote. And when one looks back at what the legacy of Theresa May is, it is truly disgraceful. I know there's lots of sympathy going out, but it is disgraceful, not to mention what happened with the Muslim rape gangs. But we also have Asia Bibi, who was hunted like an animal in Pakistan, where villages came out to try to kill her. Multitudes came out, in fact, to try to kill her, and even the judges that decided to acquit her. And she was in hiding for months after her acquittal. And Canada, and I don't think, in my opinion, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau was genuine, but he's been doing this for votes, in my opinion, since he's already said that Christians, evangelicals, are the worst element of Canadian society. But anyway, Asia Bibi tried to, there was a movement to try to get her into the UK, and it was Theresa May who stepped in and said no, and her excuse was the outcry and the upheaval that it would cause among Muslims in Britain. So in other words, she has basically subjected Britain to dimitude to Islamic law, that she will not even accept an innocent Christian that was locked up at certain points in a 2x4 cell. She would not accept her for refuge in Britain. That is an appalling thing. And this was one of her legacies. She also, unfortunately, has dismissed the whole issue about Islamic ideology and what it represents. Yes, there are those Muslims that reject it. They don't follow it. They're cultural Muslims. Yes, they have their faith. They live in peace. They choose to live in peace. And because I believe in religious rights and freedoms, I don't care if you worship a light bulb. Do it according to Western law, Western constitutions. She came out and said, as if she's an authority. She said that there are those that conduct acts of terror in the name of Islam, but it is not in the name of Islam. Why does she not go to the Grand Sheikh of Al-Azhar, go and try to preach to the Ayatollah Khomeini what Islam is, and see what happens to her? Why doesn't she open up her mouth in those countries to try to prove how peaceful normative Islam is? Instead, she's opening her mouth like she's an expert in Britain when people are suffering. There was a poor Muslim lady that ended up going back to a home to be beaten and raped by her husband under those Sharia laws, under one of those Sharia courts. And another one, honor killing, was just dismissed. It was approved. This is the kind of a thing going on where even the mainstream media reported that these courts are operating beyond the reach of British law. That is the legacy that Theresa May has left. She has crushed down free speech. She said, we value free speech, but we also value tolerance to others. Now, what the heck does that mean, tolerance to others? Does it mean if you make a joke and you offend somebody, it means you're intolerant? This is the kind of UK that Theresa May was actually forming and continuing to help in the direction of Islamization. This is what she has done. And she also surrendered to the EU with its demands for increased immigration even after Brexit. She came out and said that she will continue the expectations of the EU. She botched a lot during her time. And with what Robert Spencer indicated here, she will be remembered because she took Britain along a path that today it is in trouble. Now, one thing that Fox reported on, and this was something positive, it indicated that the former secretary, Boris Johnson, that he's emerged as the bookmaker's favorite choice to replace May. And he has had basically a zero tolerance when it came to Islamic supremacism. Of course, he gets called the usual Islamophobic. You don't have to be all you need to do, in fact, is speak on behalf of truth. And and stand up for what Judeo-Christian democracy is, and you're called Islamophobic. Once you point out what Muslims are doing in the name of Islam, not all Muslims, definitely not all Muslims, and that should never be taken for granted. It should be common sense that when you point out these Islamic supremacists and jihadist violations, you mean them. You don't mean all Muslims. So he has come out, and he made a mockery of the last year of the burqa. He made a joke out of it. That's what he did. It was a joke. And 100 British Muslim women requested that he be thrown out of the Conservatives in a letter of the party because he made that joke. Again, we see Islamic supremacism. We see Muslim Brotherhood bully tactics all over the West. You do not mess with Islam or we will be on your case with the Islamophobia battering ram. This is what happened with Boris Johnson. He refused to apologize. So they decided to take it a step further and do a poll as to what Brits think about his joke and about his about the accusation of him being an Islamophobe. Well, to their surprise, the poll showed that a large majority of Brits do not believe that criticizing the burqa is racist, which it certainly isn't. Even Morocco has banned it, and so has Chad, in the name of security, and they would, in fact, support banning the burqa. So it ended up backfiring, and of course, what happens in cases like this, the hoopla just dies down.
Well, one of the things I saw over there as well, Christine, was what happened to Tommy Robinson. My gosh, even the law enforcement was engaged against him. And even a campaign rally that he had 2-3 days ago in Oldham, I think is the town that he was in, that apparently, according to him, was not even a Muslim majority town. And he just tried to have a campaign rally, and here the law enforcement, the police, were actually leading the Islamist band of Muslims to his campaign rally, where they started throwing scissors and rocks. Didn't matter what was in the crowd listening to Tommy,
and
it appears the rally.
Yes. I mean, it's frightening. And a couple of days before that, they were throwing bricks at him.
Yes.
It's as though they've been trying to kill this fellow for standing up for British law, for standing up for the Constitution.
They threw
him in jail. They hoped they would do him in then. And now that he's out, they're trying to stir up rage and stir up violence against him, and they're standing down on protecting him, the police. This is appalling. People who are throwing these weapons, why are they not being taken and thrown in jail? Every Brit should be appalled and terrified that the law in this case has turned against them. I see a troubling trend. We look at, and we see it with Donald Trump and with Tommy Robinson. I've heard a lot of people come out and say, including on our on the conservative side and on the populist side, when it comes to Donald Trump, when it comes to Tommy Robinson, oh, I don't like them. I don't like their personality. I don't like how they do things. But people don't realize it doesn't matter. You don't have to like somebody's personality or like how they do things. Look at what they stand for. When one asks, what is it that you don't like about Tommy Robinson in terms of what he stands for, what are people going to tell you? Or what is it that you don't like about Donald Trump in terms of what he stands for, what are you going to say? Then their jaws drop because they didn't expect the question. We have lived in a society that has been too surface in a sense of we're entitled, okay? The West, all of us, we've been entitled. We have not experienced Islamic states. And I don't see – what I see happening here in our society with the Islamization of the West, people say, oh, it's all over. It's done. The sky's falling. It's done. I don't see it like that. I see it as the Muslim Brotherhood has been studying us for decades. I mean, the Muslim Brotherhood actually arrived in the Palestinian areas, Ottoman South Syria, since the 20s. And we see how the Hashemites move from Saudi Arabia over to Jordan as Muslim Brotherhood gangsters, okay, and how they do business and how they continue to operate. They have been studying Israel, have been studying Western countries for decades. It's only since 9/11 people started to wake up and say, oops, there's something against us. And we've never heard of these forces before. So we haven't had a whole lot of time to understand it. So we were awakened after 9/11 that there was indeed a force out there. But then it became, oh, it's just one segment that's violent. And then we went to, well, it's only 10% that ascribes to that violence. Well, if you add up 10% of 1.7 billion,
right,
you have, what, the population of Canada several five times over?
Exactly.
To think about what that means. And plus, we're not considering stealth jihadists. So throw the stealth jihadists in. Houston, we've got a problem here. Okay? So the world has not seen, the Western world did not understand. But when I look at the rapid rise in a short time of the populist movement, and I look at how people are starting to wake up, I have a lot of faith in the democratic system. I remember years ago when I was doing my daily interviews, I interviewed a political scientist from a university, and she said, and at that time it was nothing like this, but she had faith in democracy. That through the tests of time, and yes, it sounds maybe airy-fairy, too positive, that over the test of time, it will survive. We have seen how democracy was tested. We have seen how the Muslim Brotherhood is using it against us. But people are starting to wake up. Nobody knows where this will take us, but Europe has sure experienced a shift going from the Visegrad group, which is only Poland and the Czech Republic and Slovakia and Hungary, to we've seen it expand to Sebastian Kurz in Austria. We've seen it go to Italy. We're seeing an expansion of it, and we're seeing the movements develop even within France and Germany. We're seeing a spread of it. And in that short time, it offers hope. We've seen what's going on in Canada, that Canadians are fed up of Justin Trudeau. They're seeing what happened in Europe, and they're watching, by the way, the populist movements and the reasoning behind it. So people are starting to wake up and realize, wait a minute here, maybe the narrative that we bought for so many years, something is wrong with it. Maybe I should start thinking and wake up and realize there's something more to this. What could it be? Do these narratives really make sense? This Islamophobia that's been used again and again, the information over the internet, the information that your show is providing on a regular basis, people are listening and they're learning and they're talking about it and they're getting fed up of being second-class citizens to Islamic supremacists. The Hindus, I have talked to Hindu leaders that said we are fed up of this. They've been watching from the sidelines. A lot of people don't realize that Sikhs actually came out of Hinduism, and that's the reason why they carry the representative kirpan today, to fight against the jihadist groups that were overtaking the Hindus. People are fed up, and they're watching. We have a silent majority. Everybody, they try to make it look like hates Trump. Well, he happened to be voted in, so everybody couldn't hate Donald Trump. It's the same thing we see happening with Islamic supremacists. I believe people are waking up finally.
But I still see that our media is compromised in terms of what's being said, what's being written, what's being told to the American people. What's it like in Canada? Is the media as compromised as it is here in the States?
Definitely, definitely. In Canada, as I mentioned earlier on, we just basically have rebel media and Sun News that is in a writing form because they had a TV station and that closed down. So we have the same problem here in Canada, but I will say that we do get some honest reporting. For instance, when Justin Trudeau made an absolute fool of himself in India, the media came down hard on him. It was the mainstream media, the so-called leftist media, that actually cracked the case with his involvement, the federal government involvement with SNC-Lavalin, which is a big scandal that has truly shaken the Liberal government at the roots and resulted in some MPs actually quitting, including his right-hand man, who was called Gerald Butts. I mean, that was Trudeau's brains, but this guy ended up quitting. So since that has started to happen, the mainstream media has cracked down really hard on Trudeau, and I would say that is largely why we have seen a shift in the polls.
Interesting.
Because of the coverage with SNC-Lavalin and the coverage that we see happening with the ISIL fighters. So there is a trend. And yes, people talk about left-wing, right-wing, and there's this constant slamming the media, which they, believe me, deserve to be slammed because they're still not up and coming and honest. But at the same time, they were not easy on Justin Trudeau when it came to the SNC-Lavalin case, nor were they easy on him when he blew it in India and made a fool of Canada on an international plane. In fact, mainstream media was talking about this man has really messed this up internationally. He's managed to make enemies out of Saudi Arabia, make enemies out of China, and he's making a fool out of everywhere he goes of himself because he can't even speak. So he's being made a mockery of, and you know, even the media, the leftist media, is saying the honeymoon is over. So we are seeing trends, that, and I think it's because of that that we're seeing the shift. Because had the media not cover this or even expose what was going on with SNC-Lavalin, how would the average person have known about it who only pays attention – well, I shouldn't say that, I should rephrase that – who mostly pays attention to the mainstream media? A lot of people now go to the internet to find alternative sources because they realize that they were being blinded. And as a result, I think this may also put pressure on – the mainstream media to maybe wake up a little and start to at least report on some truth. That's a hope. In the States, I don't know, that CNN, it seems to be quite hopeless, but at the same time, there is alternative media and people are watching.
And that's exactly what I think somewhat is happening here, but we've got so many mainstream media sources here, CNN, MSNBC, and all of those that are just so far left. Even Fox is starting to lean that way, so that it's very difficult.
Troubling.
Yeah, it's very troubling. And so you have to go to your alternate sources, and not easily acceptable by, you know, a lot of the providers around the United States. So it's a little more difficult, but people are starting to do it, I think. I think you're right.
Yes. I think people are also, they're at a loss. They see Islam, which it is, as something complex. They want to believe the best. And this is a question I always get because of my book, The Challenge of Modernizing Islam, people say, is Islam a religion of peace? And I say, normative Islam is absolutely not a religion of peace, and there's nothing to prove. There was nothing ever existing to even show remotely that it is. However, there are those that may choose to follow it in peace, and that's a different story. But people are confused because they're constantly hearing, this is a religion of peace. When you look at what's going on with ISIS, when you look at what's going on with Al-Qaeda, this has nothing to do with Islam. The problem is that when one looks at, and people don't dig deep enough because there have been alliances between Turkey and ISIS and Saudi Arabia and ISIS, and people don't realize that the Sunni brand of Islam called the Hanbali doctrine of Islam, because there are four schools of jurisprudence within Sunni Islam, the Hanbali is the worst. When I say worst, I mean the most, the cruelest form, if you want to put it that way, the harshest. This is what Saudi Arabia ascribes to, the Wahhabism. That is Hanbali Islam. And this is also what ISIS ascribes to. So people that come out and say in the West, the biggest question that should be asked to them is, what are you talking about? You are telling Saudi Arabia, you are telling the Marja, the Ayatollah Khomeini, what Islam is? Are you stupid? You're going to preach to these people what Islam is? You must be stupid.
Well, if they just followed what happens every Ramadan, which is identified as their holiest season, it is not a peaceful religion. I don't even call it a religion at this point. I'm using air quotes as I say that even. So,
actually, Ramadan, a report came out that indicated, and This was published in Breitbart, actually, so I covered it for Jihad Watch, that Ramadan rage has left 364 dead and 404 injured in 2 weeks.
Exactly.
Now, this kind of a thing. Now, why is it that this is not on front pages everywhere? The public should be outraged that they are being manipulated and they're being regarded as too stupid to handle the truth and process the truth. Just because we see the jihad terror going on in the world does not mean that every Muslim is guilty. Why is it that people somehow believe that Americans, that people of the West, Canadians, cannot handle the truth? The truth is the truth. Let's accept it for what it is and go from there to make the world a better place.
Personally, I don't think it's a question of not being able to handle the truth. I think they're afraid of lawfare from CARE.
Yes.
Because how can you attack Islam?
Yeah. No argument there. They're layers. They're layers. Because I've actually met the journalists that say, you know, we shouldn't be saying this because it might lead to an unleashing against Muslims. There are those who are genuinely afraid that what people will do with this information. And it's that group that I'm talking about. But you're referring to another group, which is actually more sinister. And it is willful. And it is a willful manipulation of the public in order to get them to surrender and to break down the Constitution. And that is another layer altogether and the most dangerous layer we're talking about.
Yep.
Well, we're just talking about the media and the deception. And again, this is why we go to Jihad Watch on a regular basis to look at the articles. I, I'm a little interested in your process. You wake up in the morning. My guess is by the end of your workday, you have produced three or more articles, and you get input from around the world. You connect those articles. You give us a summary. You give your own editorial on top of it, and then give us the articles to read as well. I'm just curious, on any given day, what is it like to be a writer at Jihad Watch? How do you do what you do?
I would say for me, it's been a journey. But I want to start by really applauding Robert Spencer. That man is a hero out there. He's not just an activist against the worst abuses of jihad terror. He's also a supporter of human rights. You would not find a more non-racist person than Robert Spencer. And on top of that, he is a superb academic. He is brilliant. He raised up Jihad Watch as a news aggregate site. And when one looks at the kind of information he gives, because he has been a mentor to a lot of people in teaching them about the doctrines of Islam, there's still those that say, I don't want to get into the doctrine of Islam. I just want to get into what I see with Islamization. Well, you can't separate them, because religious zeal is an incredible force and a power. Robert Spencer understands it, and he knows about the Quran. He knows about the Hadiths. He knows about the Sunnah. He knows about the reliance of the traveler and basically every book out there that is Islamic doctrine that we have, the so-called 10% of violent Muslims following, as well as the stealth jihad and the Muslim Brotherhood plan, as well as the history of the Muslim Brotherhood. He knows these things. He's the author of over 14 books. I can't keep up with how many he's produced. So Jihad Watch is a rich site that he has created to give that education. At any given moment, aside from the news aggregate, being a news aggregate site, one can put into the search engine about any topic, and you will find videos that Robert Spencer has delivered that gives his knowledge of the subject matter, that imparts all that knowledge through years and years of research and writing. So I want to start by saying that, because that is the foundation of Jihad Watch. It's an honor to me to write for the site. My journey started as a journalist when I was very young, as a news reporter covering crime and politics in Canada for radio. And then I ended up in TV, and then I ended up in writing. And in fact, I was actually writing at one time as a national columnist for Metro News, co-owned by the Toronto Star. I was kind of the right-wing token. So I've had quite the journey. Now, with Jihad Watch, it's been difficult, because when I first started, I found this is something that I don't talk much about, but aside from journalism and following the career of journalism, I also have a bachelor's in psychology with a minor in business. And that was very useful with the Canadian Race Relations Foundation. So I understand people. I'm quite sensitive about human rights abuse. It bothers me. When I started out doing this, it was an intense pressure. It wasn't just writing a story, and that was always a problem I had. These were real people to me. These are people that are suffering at the hands of a supremacism, just like Marxism, just like Stalinism. They are suffering. Don't people care about these people suffering under supremacism? So every single story I wrote, it would be a heavy load to do this day after day, to see the negativity, to practically bathe yourself in it day after day, to analyze it, to write about it. But since, it's become more of a human rights goal, where you put this up, and yes, it was always about human rights, but there comes a point where you do it because you understand why you have to do it. And in particular, when I see what's happening today, there is an urgency for information to get out there. And through the experience of writing daily for Jihad Watch for years, it doesn't affect me with the same, and yes, it affects me what's going on, so I don't want to minimize that, but not on the same emotional level as it once did. I've gotten a little more accustomed to doing it on a daily basis, and the work has to be done. The information has to get out there. People need the knowledge to understand what's happening. It's just really good to be part of this, even though I got fired by the Canadian government for doing so.
Well, we're glad.
It was worth the effort.
Where you are. Okay. Yes. By the way, I want to make the comment, the articles that you publish also have a positive side to them. You are also chronicling progress and people standing up. Just to mention a couple of articles, you've got an article about the Thomas More Law Center taking a case, a Maryland school case, to the Supreme Court, where a Maryland school was denigrating Christianity. You've got an article about other people pushing back and fighting back.
Yes, important.
And you've even got one which as we're getting near probably the end of our time, unless we have some questions, you even got an article there about Australia. Australia would be another part of the former British Empire and probably a country that Canadians know a lot about. And you cover this result in Australia, which was a surprise. Maybe you can say a few things about that. Apparently, Mr. Morrison surprised people. I think his name is Scott Morrison, with a win that shocked media and pollsters. And it's partly because of his take on what we've been talking about. Can you talk a little bit about that article?
What I find really interesting about this latest election with Australia was, in the first place, the surprise about him winning. It was the media had decided that they were going to target Johnson, I believe her name was. I don't have the article right here in front of me, and I write so many names, I tend to forget names anyway, so that doesn't help at all, okay? So the media had decided that her name is Johnson, I believe, and if I could find it, I'll find it, but they had decided she's the one that could potentially win, so we're going to lace into her as an Islamophobe, as a racist. And they had already decided that this guy can't possibly win. He's a centrist. So they didn't put anything there because they didn't see it was a possibility. What they didn't understand was Australians, and I find that surprising because right before the elections, days before the elections, Australians were polled, and they were found to be quite balanced. They were actually pro-immigration, but they were not positive. They were negative, in fact, toward Islam. So what that shows is that they understand that countries are based on immigration, but people need to adapt. Islam is not. When one looks at the problems, and again, it's not everybody we're referring to, but when one looks at the problems going on throughout Europe, this is coming from a supremacist identity rooted in a belief system, and there is no adaptation. Australians are open to immigration, but they're not open to Islamization. This guy that's centrist understands that. He came down quite hard on jihad when it came to certain issues regarding Australia. He is not for the niqab. When he sees that Muslim Brotherhood folk and jihadists stand up, he will kick back. But he is a moderate kind of a guy. And when I use the word moderate, I mean centrist, because yes, like he reflects Australians. Yes, I'm pro-immigrant. Maybe he has said a few mushy things here and there that people define him as centrist. But what really intrigued me was that the minute he won, all of a sudden the news media were referring to him as populist. So he went from centrist immediately to populist because he had won the elections and because he is not what you would call a stooge of Islamic supremacists.
Good for
us. So I found that win quite interesting.
Yeah, I did too, and I like the way that you covered it in at Jihad Watch. In fact, one of the things that got my attention, we'll digress for just a second. We've been fortunate enough to be able to have some really wonderful experts in national security, including Center for Security Policy people like Claire Lopez with us. And she, in just a more recent webinar, talked about Erdogan and Turkey and how dangerous they are for America. And what I found interesting, in your article, you actually mentioned that this gentleman, Morrison, everybody thought was going to lose, he actually said something about Erdogan. He said that as Australia's leader, would consider breaking ties with Turkey over their leader, Erdogan's threats tied to the New Zealand massacre. And he quoted Erdogan as saying that if Australians with anti-Islam views come to Turkey, we, the Turkish, will send them back in caskets.
In caskets,
so,
yes.
That's just a coincidence because we've just been studying Erdogan and Turkey. So there is some hope for Australia, hope for North America, hope for Canada, and hope for America. And I think Jihad Watch is doing a great job of keeping us on top of all those things. And Christy,
well,
you should be very proud of your participation in that.
I certainly am.
With that, let me ask Eliza Jane, do we have any questions from our audience, or do you have any final comments or questions, Eliza?
Well, I have one final question, and Christine, run for office. Have you thought about it?
I've been asked, but I just want my life to be peaceful.
Oh, I understand that. I understand that. But my gosh, what you know and how you could help lead Canada would be amazing. And we've got a few folks in the chat room that are saying, we'd vote for her.
I'll keep that in my heart somewhere.
I think that's a great tribute. What we're really talking about here is having people who will tell the truth and people who will not spend their lives in a political career and will not try to balance off this group or that group, but will just simply tell the truth. You tell it so well. Your writing and your articulation of the issues is wonderful. So you would be a model for someone who might run for office. And I mean that. I think we're blessed this evening with hearing from you and learning from you. So we want to thank Christine very, very much for joining us and invite people to follow Christine Douglas Williams at Jihad Watch.
Thank you very much. It was an honor meeting all of you. Only
Christine,
on the radio, but it was an honor.
Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you very much.
As you listen to the song, remember to say North America. We're all going to stay together. As the United West says, one team, one fight. We need a very strong North America, a strong Canada to keep America going as well. So God bless the USA and Canada.
Tomorrow all the things were gone, I worked for all my life, and I had to start again with just my children and my wife. I thank my lucky stars to be living here today, but the flag still stands for freedom, and they can't take that. Tennessee, across the plains.